The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, August 5th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Igor Volsky on his book, Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns. Of course, over the weekend, 29 dead, over 50 injured in two mass killings, one motivated by explicit white supremacy. Meanwhile, Mexico will take legal actions over the shooting of six of those people in El Paso, Mexican nationals. Donald Trump supposedly calls for something. Meanwhile, in other news, another Republican House retirement. The fourth from Texas in about 2 weeks. Nine. Brings the total to nine in 2019. Meanwhile, Stephen King will get a challenge from the challenger that nearly beat him in 2018. Miners in Harlan County, Kentucky, still protesting, head to court to seek back pay. Defense Secretary wants to place new intermediate-range missiles in Asia. Bye-bye, INF Treaty. Meanwhile, Turkey on the brink of an invasion of northern Syria, looking to attack the Kurds in Rojava. The Indian government revokes Kashmir's autonomy in a serious provocation. And Florida Congress members want the FBI to explain how they are not sure that hackers didn't manipulate the voting in 2018. And while Stephen Miller emails show his attacks are not just on so-called illegal immigration, but also legal immigration. And finally, we did it, folks. July was the hottest month in recorded history around the world.
Really felt that, right?
Records all over the place.
It's bizarre when you can, you know, personalize it like that. Like,
well, geez, you can't because you can't feel it all around the globe.
Fair enough, but at least in New York City.
It was hot.
It's nice to know I wasn't just being a baby.
No.
All this and more on today's program. Sorry for the late start, folks. We had some technical issues. Obviously a horrible weekend. I feel like over the course of doing this show for, 8-9 years, this iteration, the number of times we've had to do shows like this has just been insane. And, it is very, very hard to not become jaded about this stuff because there doesn't seem to be any progress. We had nearly two dozen toddlers, elementary school kids killed a couple years ago, and nothing happened. Nothing happened. It looked like something was going to happen. Everybody says this time it's different. Nothing happens. There will come a day where something will happen. I don't know if that it's now. I doubt it. The fact of the matter is that as a bottom line, there's one thing I can assure you. That if there's a Republican president and the Republicans control either house, nothing meaningful will happen. That is the one thing I can tell you for sure. I can't guarantee you that if there is a Democrat in the White House and the Democrats control both houses, that there would be any meaningful legislation. And I can't tell you that if there was meaningful legislation in that instance, I can't tell you that it could go to the Supreme Court and survive there at this point. But the one thing I can tell you that is absolutely, I am 100% sure of, that there will be no meaningful legislation with a Republican in a position to veto a bill and with a Republican sitting atop one of the two houses in which to stymie a bill from hitting the floor or being voted on or being crafted. That's just the reality of it. And that doesn't mean that we should stop, you know, pushing for change. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't, that we should assume nothing's ever going to change. It just means that you need to have clear-eyed perspective on it. And the fact of the matter is that as much as there is support, I'll talk about this with our guest, as much as there is support for varying degrees of gun control and gun safety, whatever you want to call it, taking away every gun, the bottom line is it's not the way that those people who believe that vote. They don't vote on that first. And specifically in terms of like the Republicans who believe that, right? I mean, it's we're talking about 25% will make the difference there. 20%. Republicans who believe there should be sensible gun control, it's very far down the list. Way after taxes and for a certain percentage of those, way after something that's going to be harsh on, keeping the brown hordes at bay. That's just the reality of our situation right now. So people should just keep that in mind. We're less than 24 months away. It could be a completely different situation. 18 months from now, there could be theoretically a democratically controlled Senate, a democratic president, and a severely debilitated NRA, a disoriented Republican Party, who knows? So this is not, it's not bleak. I don't think there was anybody in 2008 who thought that we would get marriage equality, that within 10 years, no one would even be talking about it anymore. Like it would be so settled that people aren't even talking about it anymore. So don't lose hope. Now, there's two parallel stories that are going on here. One is that we have a massive problem with guns. And anybody but an idiot or a liar will tell you that. We have a massive problem with guns in this country. The other problem that we have is we have a burgeoning, radicalized, violent, right-wing extremism that is a contagion. And you can look at it a bunch of different ways. The conservative movement in this country has moved to the right. And they've moved to the right in terms of like numbers of people as to where they are. And as you move all these people down the spectrum of right-wing politics, they start bumping into the outer fringes of violence, like we see from people, let's say, like Timothy McVeigh, right, who killed, 180 people in blowing up a federal building. And as these people move towards that thing, you start to get more and more sort of, marginal people. There's just more people in the margins. And the marginal ideas have more salience for more people. And In this instance, they convened an 8chan, and there's attempts now. At the very least, you can't shut it down, but you can make it, you can debilitate it. But they're going to find another place. And they're getting a tremendous amount of support. Of 30,000 foot support, as it were. Like, the reason why things are moving to the right is because their leadership. Because what is considered, you know, sort of appropriate behavior has moved to the right. And so those marginal people at the margins, they're sliding to the right too. And there's just more people who are going into that sort of like zone on the spectrum of like right-wing violence. I mean, we have played, I can't tell many, how many clips of Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, others on Fox talking about the invasion. How many times have we said all of this invasion talk is going to lead to someone basically like, what do you do if you're being invaded? Well, you pick up a gun and you fight the invaders, right? I mean, that's what's going to happen. And, you know, it's happened. It's happening. It's unclear what went down in Dayton. We don't know. There's a lot of different mixed reports, but there's reason to believe that the guy was inspired at the very least to go commit an act of violence by the guy from El Paso who was doing that explicitly in service of a right-wing political agenda. Explicit. And we're still waiting to hear more about this Dayton guy, but there's a lot of rumors going around. All we know is that he clearly was, you know, had something like this planned. Apparently, according to his friends in high school 10 years ago, the guy was suspended for having a rape and kill list that many people were aware of. As far as we know, he didn't leave a screed like the guy in El Paso. But maybe we'll know more when we find out. He killed his sister, incidentally, in Dayton. His sister was among those who were dead. He had gone out with a group of people, it's my understanding, gone out with a group of people, including his sister, to that area, then disappeared, and then came back. There's a lot of rumors about who the group of kids were that were out, or young adults, I guess, 20s. And who the girlfriend, who the sister's boyfriend was. We're going to find out more information later. But we do know the El Paso attack was explicitly a political, an act of political terrorism. There's no doubt about it. That's just like irrefutable. Here is Beto, who obviously represents that area or from Congress. And He just has hit the breaking point, I guess, in terms of like the questions from the press.
Is there anything in your mind that the president can do now to make this any better?
What do you think? You know the shit he's been saying. He's been calling Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals. I don't know. Like members of the press, what the? Hold on a second. You know, it's these questions that you know the answers to. I mean, connect the dots about what he's been doing in this country. He's not tolerating racism. He is promoting racism. He's not tolerating violence. He's inciting racism and violence in this country. So, you know, I don't know what kind of question that is.
He's making remarks.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, and he's right. He's right. I mean, we're going to play a clip of Donald Trump getting up there, reading from a teleprompter and saying it, and it's completely meaningless. It's absurd. There is one thing that Donald Trump can do to help the situation go away, but he's not going to do that, of course. But, I mean, to ask these questions, you know, I'm going to read a piece a little bit later in the program by Tom Sacco about the press involvement in this. And you could see it at the debate, framing things about immigration as if, like, you know, of all the different things that could take place in the idea of this country upholding its asylum laws or being welcome to the, you know, the people who have suffered horrible tragedies in these countries that they're coming from. You could frame a question of, like, do you think that we should give extra validity to claims of refugees from Guatemala because of our historic involvement in destabilizing their country? Like, that seems like a valid question. Do you think that we should actually pay them reparations? Do you think that we should have a Marshall Plan? Do you think that... what's your feeling about the studies that show that immigrants actually increase our GDP, that they enhance our tax base? There's a myriad of different questions you could ask, but every single one of the questions was like, what do you think about them taking our welfare? What do you think about them taking our jobs? Right? It's all framed in that one fashion. And to ask a question is, can Donald Trump help anything, is like denying the reality of what's been going on. It's absurd. I understand they have to ask a question, but it's absurd. Here's Donald Trump giving his speech. He said that the attack happened in Toledo. He couldn't remember the El Paso, and he had to. But here he is.
The shooter in El Paso posted a manifesto online consumed by racist hate. In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Hate has no place in America. Hatred warps the mind, ravages the heart, and devours the soul. We have asked the FBI to identify all further resources they need to investigate and disrupt hate crimes and domestic terrorism.
All right. So over the past 18 months or so, there's been over 2,000 Facebook ads placed by the Trump campaign with the use of the word invasion, is my understanding. He has regularly tweeted out, we're being invaded. I mean, let's go to where he was in Panama City Beach, Florida. When was this? Like a month ago?
May?
I was badly criticized for using the word invasion. It's an invasion. Folks, it's crazy. And then they say, and the wall would help because it would not help. The wall would stop it. Okay? The wall would stop it. I mean, when you have 15,000 people marching up and you have hundreds and hundreds of people and you have two or three border security people that are brave and great. And don't forget, we don't let them and we can't let them use weapons. We can't. Other countries do. We can't. I would never do that. But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no. That's only in the.
Somebody said shoot them in the crowd there.
Yeah.
You can't. There's no. That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement.
Yeah, only in the panhandle. Apparently not just in the panhandle.
I'd just like to add briefly, it's important. Peter Beinart did a piece last year, and a lot of people covered this, on how the Trump administration had shut down counter-violent extremism programs.
Yes.
And this is so important because these programs specifically, like, I don't want to have a whole other set of policies that reflect the policies that have been targeted against Muslim populations. That would be horrible. Just all of those policies should be dismantled. But these were programs like funding Christian Piccolini, who had the Exiting Hate Groups programs, like actually seriously productive sociological programs, which can basically help cult deprogram people. the Trump administration defunded all of them.
I mean, so there's, you know, this is, some people have, you know, we have two issues here, right? We have the guns that are so readily available to anybody with a desire to hurt themselves or anybody else, which is a massive problem. And then we also have this sort of growing, not sort of, we have a growing right-wing violent movement in this country, and that some people basically say, like, you know, people say there's coming civil war. Civil war could already be here. It's just that it's extremely low level at the margins. And I don't know at what point, I mean, at what point, again, you know, and I've had this question about, you know, when Mike Pence is going and overseeing all the brown people in the cages. You know, at what point have we crossed a certain threshold where something is what it is? I mean, if we get 50 people shot every weekend for a specific political ideology, violence happens. Accidents happen. That science guy, what's his face? I can't remember.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Neil deGrasse Tyson put out like a thing like saying, hey, folks, everybody got to remain calm. More people die in car accidents by a factor of 20, and more people die by choke and whatever it is. But there's a reason why terrorism is deployed. It's because it works. Because if you're at the mall and you're out of your car, you don't think you're going to get hit. You're going to be die in a car accident. If you're not eating a fish bone, you don't think you're going to choke a fish, you know, on a fish bone. There's never a moment where you're in the mall and you think, oh, I could get shot by a semi-automatic weapon now. With a guy in up armor, you know, coming in. So, I mean, it's just absurd. And this is what is political terrorism. But we got to go. I got to go. We got 5 minutes for our guest here. We'll be right back. We're going to take a quick break. Igor Volsky will be with us to at least deal with the question of guns. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, the executive director of Guns Down America, author of Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns. Igor Volsky, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I know we have just a limited time with you, Igor, but give us a sense of how realistic, you know, we have two different issues, obviously, with the shootings that took place over the weekend. One of them being the sort of the right wing extremism that's involved there. Let's put that aside for the moment and talk about the how we deal with this problem of guns. People who are listening to the show are well aware of it. I think most people know that 2/3 of gun deaths are suicides. We've talked on this program about how the easy access to guns, makes those suicides, you know, has a direct correlation to the success of those suicides, particularly by the nature of how people commit suicide and what happens and the failure rate for other ways of doing it and the narrow window of time where they're contemplating doing it, et cetera. But we also have these mass shootings, which terrify the entire society. What can we do? What have we been doing wrong?
Well, look, I mean, we know exactly what to do to reduce gun deaths. The question is, are we holding our advocates, that is, and I'm specifically talking about people in power, members of Congress, members of the Senate, to doing everything in their power that's possible. I don't understand why after the House passed universal background checks on February 27th, the Senate Democrats did close to nothing. In fact, I did a study of this. Only about 19 of them even tweeted that it happened. Okay. And now we're in a situation where it's been about 157, 158 days since the House took that action. And you haven't seen a single Democratic senator filibuster over this issue, place any kind of hold on a nominee or on a piece of legislation because of this issue. I mean, my God, why aren't they back in D.C. right now showing the country that they are ready to take action that would make it harder for people to get guns? I mean, there's a pro forma session tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning. Why aren't they trying to use that to spark the conversation? We can call on Mitch McConnell to do this, that, and the other thing. But Sam, you know that if the two of us and all of your listeners set ourselves on fire in front of Mitch McConnell's house, he wouldn't do anything because he's built an entire career on carrying water for the NRA. So we have to do everything we can. And those senators have to use their leverage as senators to push for action.
Let's just assume for a moment. I mean, they force McConnell to bring some legislation or bring that House legislation to the floor. At the very least, right, this is the process in which you gain support, where you punish people for not supporting certain legislation and you make it clear that they don't support it. But what are the outer limits of what can be done legislatively based upon the narrow confines of the Supreme Court?
Well, look, my argument is that given how the Supreme Court has interpreted Heller, how it interpreted the Second Amendment in Heller, where it found for the very first time that there's an individual right to own a gun, that even given that reality, we can actually get a whole lot of things done. So, you know, in my view, we need to crack down on the gun industry, ban military-style weapons, but also regulate the products they produce. We need licensing and registration, and we need to invest in urban areas and community-based programs to reduce gun violence there. All of those things, Sam, can be done under the confines and under the framework set out in Heller. Now, if the justices move the interpretation and write new rights into the Constitution, into the Second Amendment, then I think we should have a conversation. Is it time to amend the amendment? Is it time to rethink how we view it? But right now, under current law, everything we need to do to build a future with fewer guns, we can do.
And can those be done on a state-by-state basis? And to what extent have we seen some success there? Because it seems to me like I think I was just looking at the difference between Connecticut and maybe it was Texas in terms of just suicides. It's been helpful.
Well, absolutely. And as you know, oftentimes you've seen states try policies and then they've been federalized. So there's currently 9 states, for instance, that have firearm licensing. Those states have found great success, including Connecticut, as you point out, in reducing gun deaths. But you really need a federal solution for this, because what ends up happening is guns come in from states where they're easier to get. They're coming into the states with greater regulation. And so you need a federal floor. You need to raise that federal floor to licensing and registration. But, you know, the states who are doing the emergency risk protection orders, who are doing universal background checks, who are doing licensing, they should continue doing that. That has an impact. But to really get at this problem, we need to really raise the standard, the federal standard of gun ownership in America.
Right. I mean, we just saw that in California, where the guy bought the weapon in Nevada. I think we saw that in Ohio, where he bought the weapon, I think, by mail order in Texas. All right. So we just have a couple of minutes left here. What can people do out there if they want, if they're motivated by this? They go to your website. What can people do?
Sure. So two different things. If they want to get Senate Dems into D.C. and actually do everything they can right now, go to emergencysenatesession.org to make your voice heard. And the other piece, we didn't really talk about this, is I think Walmart really has a role to play. Why are they still selling guns? Why are they still giving money to NRA-backed candidates? Why aren't they investing in gun buybacks in the communities that they serve? They should be doing all of this. And if they do, Sam, they'll have, I think, a major impact just given their size. And so for that, I think folks should go to WalmartMustAct.org. You know, they've already moved in the right direction over the last couple of years. Now I think they need to go further. They have a role to play as we wait for legislative change. They have an important role to play in helping build the future with fewer guns.
Are they the biggest retail seller of guns in the country?
That's what's estimated. Yeah, it's hard to tell, but typically, yeah, typically because of their large footprint, they become the biggest seller.
It's more than likely that is the lowest of the low hanging fruit. To the extent that there's any fruit there that's low hanging, I would imagine it would be make the people who are profiting directly off this, or I guess maybe secondarily because they're retail, ashamed. And then so we have I'm sorry. Give us the websites one more time, both of them.
Sure. For Walmart, it's walmartmustact.org. And then for the Senate, it's emergencysenatesession.org.
All right. Well, we'll put both those at majority.fm. Igor, I know that you were really pressed for time today. I appreciate your taking the time with us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Okay. All right, folks. Sorry. I know that was abbreviated. But at the end of the day, these are all things that we've had these arguments a million times. And I think the point is well taken. I mean, I can tell you why the Democrats are so anemic in that. Part of it is because Chuck Schumer's anemic on everything. But it is a fear of alienating Trump voters on the margins with the knowledge that for someone who is pro-gun, anti-gun reform, that is their number one, like they've been able to meld these issues into one identity. Very difficult to find a gun nut who also doesn't perceive themselves as a Christian. And I don't mean they are Christian, but they perceive themselves as they ID as an evangelical Christian. I think the overlap there is pretty significant. In other words, there are signifiers on the right that have melded in. Used to be deficit hawkery too, but they were able to jettison that one pretty quickly. But guns, God, what was the third thing that Obama said? Guns, God, and religion?
Seems a little repetitive.
Yeah, it seems. I think there was one other thing. But nevertheless.
I don't remember the third thing.
I guess it's God, guns, and their religion.
Yeah, I think it was a bit redundant.
These white people are so stupid, they can't even disaggregate.
But it becomes a surrogate for all the complaints. It's the source of their power. And they vote on it. That's just the bottom line. But it's, head to those websites. We'll put them on majority.fm's site. They take you to Guns Down America, different campaigns. I don't know why the Democrats are not using more on filibuster, but the bottom line is I don't think there's a lot of legislation that the Republicans are trying to pass in the Senate. They could hold up the budget deals, but they'll never do that. They're all terrified of doing that. They could hold up immigration. They're not going to, the immigration reform, not get the money to immigrants, but they're terrified of that. Beyond that, there's no legislation to filibuster at this moment. You cannot stop federal judges. You could put a hold on nominees, but they're not even bothering bringing nominees to the Senate anymore. This is just the situation. It's consistent to say Democrats are weak on this. Like I say, largely because their voters do not prioritize it. I mean, we're all mad about it right now. But Joe Biden came out tomorrow, you know, if Joe Biden's the nominee and he comes out and he says, I'm just not going to push for gun reform, people are still going to vote for him over Donald Trump. But if Donald Trump came out and said, I'll give you everything you want except for we're going to take your guns, everybody, they would all vote for Joe Biden. I mean, that's just the nature of this. You know, because for normal human beings, it's like, there's a problem here. We shouldn't have to give up stuff to be able to go to the mall or send our kids to school and not feel like they're going to come back in body bags. Like, everybody just assumes like that should be, that's the baseline. We shouldn't have to give up things to get the baseline of go to the store, don't anticipate a guy in a full body armor coming in with a weapon suited for combat. The guy in Dayton shot people in a very busy Saturday night, like party area. There were cops all over the place. They had him dead within 30 seconds of his first shot. He was dead in 30 seconds. So too were 9 other people and 27 injured in 30 seconds. The good guy with a gun theory doesn't work in these circumstances. I don't know if it ever works. But if the good guy with a gun theory is just how to mitigate so that only 9 people get killed and 27 get injured. Because, I mean, it's not going to get much better than 30 seconds. I'm sorry. I mean, so it is a reasonable expectation of people as a baseline that you can go out on a Saturday night and there's not going to be someone who's coming out specifically to target all those people. If they hadn't gotten them in 30 seconds, if the cops were, instead of like on the corner across the street from him, if they were 3 blocks down and it took them 2 minutes to get to the scene, literally 2 minutes, 120 seconds, he probably would have made it into the bar that he was headed towards. And we'd be talking about, did you see the sort of the modification he had on that magazine? Apparently it was like, it looked like 2 Gatling guns.
A barrel drum sort of.
Yes.
Thing.
I don't know how many that holds.
I don't know, but I think that's the sort of modification that, remember when Tucker Carlson had that gun control advocate on and was incredulous at how many bullets could actually, they could actually spit out, and actually it turns out the gun advocates guy was right, that just hundreds of rounds.
Right. I mean, you would have been talking about, I don't know, I mean, does it matter? 9 dead versus 2 dozen dead versus 3 dozen dead?
Can I just add one thing and broaden it out a little bit? Because I absolutely agree on the need for gun control. I do not like living in the gun country. It is always in the back of my mind a little bit that somebody could murder me if they really wanted to. You know, I've been threatened by the MAGA bomber. I've gotten phone calls threatening to cut my head off. It's not good. But I also, I think nobody listening will disagree with this fact. I want to remind people that this stuff didn't come out of nowhere. This fringe movement, it didn't just come from 8chan. The things they believe in are foundational elements of this country, right? Because this country was founded on white supremacy. It was founded on settler colonialism, the violent dispossession of indigenous people from their lands and the imposition of these arbitrary borders. It was founded on slavery. And all of these things were also, of course, heavily intertwined with early capitalism. And it hasn't gone away, right? We practiced an imperialist foreign policy for pretty much the whole time. And if you want to talk about recent years, the war on terror is heavily driven by Islamophobia. So it is hard to say that these guys are just into some fringe ideas when these things are so heavily intertwined with America for its entire history.
Well, like I say, there's two separate issues. We don't know what motivated the guy in Dayton. But the thing that we do know, whether it's someone committing suicide, which accounts for 2/3 of all gun deaths in this country, whether it's someone who is trying to pursue a political terrorism, like this guy in El Paso, you want to call it a soft civil war, early civil war, nascent civil war.
And it's not just domestic. I mean, the Queensland guy was very similar in his right. rhetoric.
Indeed. And you have Breckvitt. Right. I mean, look, it's not
exclusive to this country.
Right. Anders Breivik.
But here's what is exclusive to this country. Whether you're talking about the 30,000 suicides by guns every year, or the mass murders we see, it is the gun culture that is problematic. Yes, we have another issue, that is white nationalist extremism. But I'd much rather those guys, you know, have baseball bats and knives for a while and try and figure out if they want how to make an explosive and, you know, blow their hands off in their basement.
They leave a much larger trail that way too.
Yeah, of course.
I don't think anyone's going to argue with you on that.
Well, but that is the point. I mean, yes, the impetus that drove that guy to shoot up people, although he was also anti-corporate, apparently. But that was because that they're letting in immigrants.
Tucker Carlson special.
Exactly. Right up Tucker Carlson's alley. I mean, Tucker Carlson, let's face it. If you're Tucker Carlson today, I'm sure you feel bad about the loss of life. I mean, look, I have no idea what Tucker Carlson feels. But let's just say, let's not talk about Tucker Carlson for just a moment. We'll get to that. But let's not talk about Tucker Carlson. Let's just talk about a hypothetical person. All right? Let's call him Smucker Rawlson. And if you're Smucker Rawlson, and you go up and you promote this notion of an invasion, okay? And you promote this notion of Democrats just want immigrants in because they're going to take over the country by replacing basically white people with brown people, and they're going to get all the votes. If you put on this thing that, like, corporations don't care about us, they're willing to bring in immigrants and replace white working people.
That's the most disingenuous shit ever.
And if this Smucker Rawlson, or whatever that hypothetical guy is saying all this, and then someone hears you And they regurgitate everything you've been telling the country for years. And they write it down. And they use all your same language and your same construction and your same perspective, your same disgust with politicians who are too cowardly to do anything about it, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. Like all of the nuances, even. I'm sure you say, like, ugh, I wish this guy hadn't shot all them. I wish he did something else in support of that exact same agenda. I don't know what it would be. I don't know what it would be. What would it be? What would it be? Because this guy basically regurgitating not even the same ideology as this hypothetical person that we're talking about, but also the same frustrations about politicians aren't going to do anything about it. If you say it's an invasion, how can you look at yourself in the mirror and say, I care about this land that's being invaded, but I'm not going to do anything about it? If it's an invasion, how else do you stop them? We already saw Donald Trump's rally, the one suggestion that was there. Here is someone completely unrelated to the hypothetical character I've just talked about. This guy's name happens to be Tucker Carlson, and he's on Fox News. Let's hear.
A 250,000 people. This is an invasion. It's terrifying. And you're seeing, obviously, the.
Okay, he's talking. He's using the invasion of the people coming across the border. Here's Stuart Varney saying the same thing.
It's totally wrong.
And I'm going to call it an invasion, like it or not. Jason.
All right. Call it invasion, like it or not. Here's Varney doing it again.
This week, I'm going to be quite outspoken about this. I
Please
simply
do.
Cannot imagine that middle America, that American voters accept this invasion, this open borders policy. I simply don't believe that America accepts that.
Well, they don't. They're going to go. One of them is going to go buy a weapon and he's going to go into a Walmart and he's going to shoot everybody. Let's hear Jesse Waters using this invasion.
Bait. All right. As the illegal invasion at our southern border intensifies, AOC tours one of the overcrowded detention facilities and makes some wild claims about what she saw inside.
Yeah, what she did is a wild claim, but his a claim of an invasion. Where, who else? I mean, that can't be, that has to be it, right? There's nobody else saying anything about an invasion.
I found it amazing that Nancy Pelosi is upset that the president is having an incredible success in being able to get Mexico to finally come to the table and cooperate in stopping the invasion. And that's what it is.
It's an invasion, folks. Get your weapons. We're being invaded. Here's Beto or a clip of Beto being played on that guy, Tucker Carlson.
The president achieved nothing except to jeopardize the most important trading relationship that the United States of America has.
So, in case you're trying to follow the reasoning at home, by asking Mexico to stop encouraging an illegal invasion of our country, we're, quote, jeopardizing our relationship with Mexico.
Folks, you're being told that there's an invasion. If I keep telling you there's a fire, that the house is on fire, you show up with a hose with water, I'm not going to be like, wait, what? What are you doing? I didn't mean come up with a hose. I just meant, like, just be aware. There's a fire there. That's what's going on here. Here's Pete Hegseth. I mean, the whole network, this was a talking point.
President Trump just announced moments ago that the U.S. has reached an agreement with Mexico to stop the invasion. It is an invasion. Of illegal immigrants and
it's an invasion of illegal immigrants from Mexico. Well, if there's an invasion, we've got to stop there in that invasion.
The Minutemen.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like there's no precedent for this. It's just that this guy was just like, yeah, your tactics aren't working. Time for me to move on to mine.
And specifically, there's a really good piece in the Washington Post by Aishan Tharoor on this specific language of replacement, the great replacement theory, which connects the Trump, the rhetoric of the Trump presidency and the manifesto of at least the New Zealand terrorist. I haven't read.
We heard those guys in Charlotte.
Well,
we're marching.
You will not replace us is the same thing as this demographic determinist white supremacy, white anxiety argument. I think it is really important, though, more broadly. One of the reasons I've been really appreciating Cornel West so much right now, among many reasons, is that we can sort of his argument that there is this savage and murderous from its inception American tradition, and then there's always been the liberatory democratic American tradition as well, and we need to choose that one and actually win and embrace what's right.
Yeah, it's very dangerous to act like the only answer is the bloody one.
Precisely.
Well, I also want Democrats and liberals, I mean, you know, the ones who agree with us anyway, to be more conscious how they talk about the border. Because when you use the language of security, you use the language of safety, you use the language of the war on terror, that's not that far from this kind of white supremacist hysteria that we're hearing from the right. Maybe it's quote unquote smarter, right? They don't want a wall. They want a smart wall made with technology that they bought from Palantir, Peter Thiel's company. But it really is a slippery slope to this. Like, a lot of the infrastructure for what's happening right now was created by Obama and Clinton before him. So I just want people, well-intentioned people, left liberals, social Democrats, to think a little bit harder about these things when they talk about them.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have to be aware of the way that they're framing it. And you can have a secure border and claim,
and not just when they talk about them, sorry, like when they do the things as well, right?
Well, I don't know what they're doing.
When they grant government contracts to Palantir, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I agree.
And they vote for spending on border security.
Well, in this instance, that spending was earmarked towards trying to provide better facilities, I guess. But the idea was that there was no sort of way of maintaining the trusting, essentially, the Trump administration as to how they were going to use the money.
Oh, sure. This is going right to the nicest,
don't worry,
nicest supplies.
It's going to go right to the humanitarian.
They're going
to
get Trump-branded supplies, every one of them.
It's going to be the best Trump sheets you've ever seen.
All right, let's take a break. We're going to go into the fun hat. We'll freebie Monday. I don't give a shit. We'll take some calls. We have more of this. This is pretty stunning. Talk about shoehorning your favorite topic into this. Jake Tapper wants to make sure that he's not accused of some type of both-siderism. So for him, it's he is really trying to flatten some nuances down here a little bit. Let's just play this, and we will digest it in a moment. It's pretty sort of shocking. It just gives you a sense of where Jake Tapper is on this. And I think, you know, for some people in the news media, there's a desperate fear of taking a position of against like some type of form of white supremacy. It just seems like you're just getting too political. And so you got to balance it out. But it's a little bit tricky in this environment, in this country, to sort of balance it out by talking about, like, well, what about the Black Panthers? Weren't they violent? Or, you know, like if they get up there and they go, like, what about the Seminese liberation?
This is one I'm going to have to give Bill Maher props on this. Because, and this is years ago. I don't even remember what the context was. But he had on Raihan Salam, who's like a relatively smart conservative. And Bill Maher was actually making, it wasn't even about anything like this. It was literally like a state lawmaker said a slur somewhere. And Bill Maher was like, you want to guess which party this guy was from?
Right.
And Raihan Salam started talking about the Seminese Liberation Army or something, or the Weathermen. And Bill Maher looked at him and he was like, you weren't born yet.
Well,
like, what are you talking
well,
about?
Well, that's
dude?
The problem that people have who are desperately seeking some type of. And so you got to shoehorn it. Now, right. So where does Jake Tapper, where does he store his, like, I got to prove my bona fides?
I think we all have an idea.
Yeah, let's.
Is that, you know, you hear conservatives all the time, rightly so, in my opinion, talk about the tone set by people in the Arab world, Palestinian leaders talking about, and the way they talk about Israelis, justifying in the same way you're doing, no direct link necessarily between what the leader says and a violence against some poor Israeli girl in a pizzeria, but the idea that you're validating this hatred.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yet people don't, I mean, you can't compare the ideology of Hamas with anything else, but at the same time, if either tone matters or it doesn't.
Well, now, here's the thing. I wonder if he's really this this unnuanced in his thinking. Tone can matter, and material facts on the ground matter. So let's just compare this. I'm going to stipulate that Hamas has very bad, they set a very bad tone in terms of the way of their rhetoric, in terms of the way that they should, the Palestinians should behave towards Israelis. I'm just going to stipulate that for the sake of it, right? And we're going to stipulate that Donald Trump does the same. Now, Hamas represents people, a million plus people who are living in an outdoor jail, who have 40-some-odd% unemployment, constant food insecurity. They have every couple of years, if you're a civilian, like, and we got to presume that all million people, let's just, well, can I get everybody to agree that, like, all million people are not attacking Israel with the kites? Okay. Can we just say that? Like, let's say we can.
I don't know what Jake can agree to.
Right. Well, let's just say that Jake, I'm sure Jake would concede that 500,000 right. of the people there are not. Right. I'll stipulate the other 500,000 are all sending kites across into Israel that are flaming kites. Okay. 500,000 of those people are doing it, but 500,000 are not. And those people are still also subjected to, you know, every several months bombings or.
No freedom of movement.
No freedom of movement, the economic deprivation. Whereas the people subject to the tone of Donald Trump are subject to the same stagnant wages of the people that they're attacking. They're living under a Republican administration, so there's cuts in all sorts of support in terms of their environment, and corporations are getting all the tax cuts and whatnot. But you can say that tone matters and also not equate the situation that these right wingers are living in with the situation of the people of the Palestinians are living
in. I also have to say, I mean, what makes it even worse, and again, I'm, of course, I can condemn any number of things about Hamas. I think that we have to uphold certain basic standards or there's no standards to uphold, right? I don't have any problem with that as long as you understand the profound power asymmetry. But what makes that even more racist and ridiculous, I'll use those words to describe it myself, I'm not putting that on anybody else, is that the direct analogy you could draw if you wanted to talk about the Middle East would be Netanyahu and the Israeli government, right? Like, if you want to talk about a pretty direct
demographic
analogy,
threat,
which
right.
is, oh, a governing party that is in power and has control over things.
But he's not
uses
looking
incitement,
for
incitement, bigoted. I know he's not looking
for an analogy.
You know what he
he's been, looking for
he
gone, a license to be able to critique
well,
a white nationalist.
Precisely.
And the only way I can get that right. license if I show my bona fides by saying, however, there are some brown people I do think deserve it.
Precisely. Precisely. Well, and he does that all the time. I mean, he's always fear-mongering and always distorting what's happening in the Middle East. But again, I don't want to give him any ideas, but if he went to Pakistan and he said, well, this is a thing like the ISI and some members of the Pakistani military, they play a double game where they work with us on certain security issues, but then they back the Taliban and they fund certain preachers who do instigating rhetoric. Isn't that like... It would have been also a ridiculous, stupid stretch, but at the very least, he wouldn't have done one that directly
here's the better,
implicated.
Here's the better thing that he could
exact
say.
Exact example. Netanyahu is Trump.
Here's the better example he could say, if you're looking for that tone. We assassinated an American citizen named Anwar al-Awlaki.
Indeed.
Based upon, supposedly there was operative ties. But they were never made public or proved. That's one of the beauties about being able to assassinate somebody. It makes the court case a lot simpler. But the big complaint right. was that he was inspiring people, radicalizing them online in video clips. I don't know if he was saying, like, it's an invasion, and then people adopted the terms, it's an invasion. But the idea was that he was saying something, and they were adopting those terms in that frame. But again, maybe not as it doesn't work quite as well.
He's not doing a good job making us disbelieve the credible rumor reported by David Kleon from someone who used to work for Jake Tapper that he pushed for greater scrutiny of Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib in advance of the midterms.
Well, one never knows. I would not be completely surprised by that. I don't ever remember Jake Tapper being like this.
He's always had a real thing for Israel identity stuff. And then also for just like having tantrums about Louis Farrakhan. And again, I'm like all my jokes aside, of course I'm not a fan of Louis Farrakhan.
He's not a leftist.
One, he's not a leftist. And two, like, I'm sorry. Louis Farrakhan has very little power in the society. I mean, that's really what all of these things come down to. Do you want to actually be real about who has power, who doesn't? That's one of the reasons I use the Pakistan example, is you could say, like, yeah, there's right-wing Islamic forces that have a lot of power in Pakistan, and they cause a lot of problems. Like, at the very least, let's just do some actual power symmetries here. But and that's not what he has any interest in.
It's also bizarre, too, because when you think about it, like, right, like the idea is that, well, it's the president saying this. And so that is like at the heart of sort of like the president is completely central, like is centered in what we consider to be mainstream society, right? Like the president just sort of largely, generically, is considered to be centered in our society. And you could argue that Hamas is centered in the Palestinian society, at least within the context
sort of
Gaza. And you could argue that when the president says something, everybody thinks like, oh, that's normal mainstream. When Hamas says that it's normal mainstream, that's the case. I guess maybe his argument is about like the implications for it's just a very weird
analogy.
He's
talking about social sanctioning, but also for what it's worth, Hamas's rhetoric has changed radically like
yes.
in the last 10 years. So that would be that's the other problem with the analogy. It would actually be like if 10 years from now somehow we had another Republican president who had steadily de-escalated all of the instigating language.
The so-called progressives are actually regressive.
Yeah, that guy has instigated his language every step of the way, and there's members of the Israeli government who are not him who have literally called for genocide in a place that they are actually occupying and regularly killing civilians in. So you could do some pretty exact analogies if you wanted to. But I'm sure you have some questions about why Medicare for All is bad.
Right. This actually I enjoyed. It's on MSNBC. And Eddie Glaude was going in Sunday morning to talk about this. I'd say, I noticed on Twitter he had said like he wasn't sure what he was going to say. Eddie's a pretty impressive guy, I think. And
we need him.
Is a has a very good sense of sort of like a moral conscience and can articulate this. And apparently, Eddie Glaude had said on the program that Mick Mulvaney can barely acknowledge it. Now, you'll note today, on Monday, we're what, 2 days later, right? Donald Trump comes out and addresses the nation. First thing, now, to be fair, he was stuck in his golf resort and he was playing golf, and so he couldn't get back. But they know they had to do something. They knew that this was a political liability, and I think largely it was because of what people on the press were doing and saying. At the end of the day, I don't know if that's, you know, that's just the way that politics works. He's not going to do anything about it. He's not going to do anything about it.
Just covering my ass.
I'm going to be really robotic when I say the parts about white supremacy, and so all my peeps will know I had to say it. And I guarantee you, if wherever these cretins have gone, if they're not at 8chan anymore, they're on Stormfront or whatever, Storm Daily Front, whatever it is now, and they're saying he had to say that. And he did. But apparently Mick Mulvaney had seen Eddie Glaude, I guess, earlier in the broadcast of this show and had tweeted out something. And Chuck Todd says, what do you say back to Mick Mulvaney, to Eddie Glaude?
And we had a unique situation here in that Mick Mulvaney ended up hearing a panel discussion that he actually might not have heard had our satellite worked on time that time. But he clearly, Eddie Glaude, was reacting to you in particular in that interview. What did you hear from him?
First of all, I can give less than a damn what Mick Mulvaney thinks about what I say, to be honest with you. He can't even acknowledge that it was a domestic terrorist act. How many times did you use the phrase and he wouldn't acknowledge it? What did he say? He said it was a person who was crazy, a nut with guns, right? And that's always the case, right? If it was a Muslim, it would have been a terrorist act. Donald Trump would have already been on television, not a tweet. He would have already done a press conference, right? But when it's white men engaging in this sort of action, we get this sort of account, right? That we want to go to their mental health. Let's just stipulate that they're crazy. Let's stipulate that they're crazy.
Everybody who kills people are crazy.
Something's wrong. Let's stipulate to that. Yeah. But there's an ideology at work here. When you use...
What about the troops? But I digress.
Everybody who kills people are crazy.
Something's wrong. Let's stipulate to that. Yeah. But there's an ideology at work here. When you use the same language that we've heard, the same language that we heard in the clip. And let me say this. For a lot of folk in this country who are black and brown, for a lot of folk in this country who are not white men, it feels as if some white men have lost their damn minds, Chuck, and we have to bear the burden of it.
I mean, hard to argue.
I want to just add, too, that it is important, because Matt and I have been trying to emphasize this, though, that, and I have no doubt that the reason Trump came out and was so, for him, unequivocal is clearly there must be some bad polling or something they're responding to. I don't believe for a second that there's any conscience in this at all. There has to be something they're responding to. That's my 100% assumption. And that means that outside of a incredibly dangerous and empowered base, that a lot of people, including people who might not be so woke or whatever, are at the very least objecting to this extreme grotesque version of it.
They want the deniability.
But also that most people genuinely didn't like go back to where you come from comments. They actually got it and understood it. And I think that sense of a broad set of normal people having a reaction to this is something that we really should capitalize on and think about. And I think, and I'm sure Eddie, you know, I would be really interested to hear what he thought about this as well, is that, like, where is the balance between that? Undoubtedly this is talked about and treated differently because it's white supremacist terrorism versus Islamic terrorism. And I don't want to adopt the same failings in the response to Islamic terrorism. So, no, like, we've always been making the argument from the beginning that, like, yeah, if you want to deal with Islamic terrorism, you do have to deal with
alienation and foreign policy and all of these other factors, as well as a toxic ideology. So I would just say that should be applying here as well. The first step is to be honest about what it is, but we don't want to just securitize this either, because that's also it's bad policy, frankly.
Well, also, I think you need to contextualize, like, what exactly is the what are those material things that are and contextual things that are driving it? I don't think that it's the ideology of white supremacy that is new, no. Right? I mean, it's not. Obviously, all this stuff has been there, and there are certain material things that are driving this in some way. But I think with a lot of these people, they are marginal figures, and you have the president basically giving a validation and saying, here's the world, here's the scenario, and this is what is right about it. I mean, I think like...
That's 100% right.
And he is weaponizing that in a way that it has not been weaponized in this country for a long time.
And the analogy in some way still holds because, you know, the Saudis weaponized that through how they fund it. But as an example, like... Li Fang, who, you know, triggers people for whatever reason, I think he's actually, I don't agree with all of his takes, but he's a very good reporter. He tweeted out that something that we have to consider is, as an example, the record levels of like loneliness and alienation that young men are experiencing, right? And some people jump to that's a justification, which it absolutely is not.
No, that trying to understand it is not the same thing as justifying it.
Benjamin Barber had a great line after the September 11th attacks in that virile environment. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, but it was understanding causes is not a justification.
Yeah.
And I think that Scott Atran, who's done a lot of ethnographic work on terrorism, he's starting to write about the alt right now. And he's talking about some of the same patterns that he finds in terms of lack of group identity, lack of meaning and cohesion in life. And actually, when I say material, I think something like the Saudis funding ideology or Donald Trump condoning it, that to me is a material base.
Right.
Yeah.
And promoting things like what Piccolini is doing. I mean, these are all part of a whole.
We also have to be able to prioritize the material factors in a way that is good and just, right? Because, you know, the advancements made by minorities, they're a factor in the backlash. Immigration is a factor in the backlash to immigration. But that doesn't mean that you should do what Hillary Clinton says and restrict immigration in order to decrease right populist reaction.
Right. I don't think that. Capitulating with the hopes of getting a reasonable response. There's no negotiation here.
No, you can only defeat them with superior power.
Right. And I think there are mitigating things that can be done, you know, and we've talked about some of them.
We really, really do need to regrow the social bonds in our society. Right. Because when you get rid of old institutions like church, family, patriarchy, I don't like these things, but they did provide some sort of social cohesion. And people are right when they say that neoliberal capitalism is intensely alienating to live under. But what do we do with that? We can't go backwards. We have to go forwards to some kind of like secular new version of community that is good for everyone's mental health.
Majority Report community centers all across the country. Third place for people. It's certainly obviously exacerbated when you hear people justifying this stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if you got a guy who's making, for instance, look, I don't think there's any question that what happened in El Paso by any definition would be considered to be political terrorism. I mean, I just don't know how. If political terrorism exists, then that's political terrorism. If that was not political terrorism, then I don't know how you define political terrorism. I don't know that that was the case in Dayton. It seems to me that what could be going on is you have a guy who clearly had some deep seated problems that were quite obvious. If you're making rape and kill lists in high school and they suspend you for it because it's going on there, that's a problem. And assuming And I think it's a fairly safe assumption that at the very least, he had that type of mentality. There are people I want to kill. There are people I want to rape. For the next 10 years or whatever it was, 8 years of his life. And he's clearly planning, someday I'm going to do something about it. I've bought weapons. I've bought body armor. And then he sees this guy go in. Maybe he's just inspired by the bravery. Or maybe he's inspired by the bravery and the ideology on some level. We don't know. But he clearly was inspired by that. And he does it the next night. The idea that he was, though, you know, bullied. And I think, you know, in the retrospective, like Columbine, I think they found there was a lot different things going on with Columbine than we first hear. That it's like, you know, alienated, bullied kids. He may be alienated. He may have had problems, but it turns out he was more of the bully. There was a whole series of people claiming to know him and using their, and as far as I can tell, the AP has vetted at least most of these. It would be pretty ballsy to use your own name and your Facebook account and whatnot to come out and say this.
Bullies can certainly be alienated too, though.
Yes.
Like, that's probably why they're bullies.
It's very possible. Brian Seitz writes this. Connor Betts was a classmate of mine, a real scumbag who threatened to kill women and attack the school. He was not bullied in school. He was a classic glorifier of violence and an all-around unpleasant person who had threatened many of my friends in the past. You can blame bullying, which would be lying. You can blame media, which would be extremely untruthful. You can blame a society where threats against women are bad enough to get you kicked out of high school are simply forgotten and allowed to ferment for almost a decade so he can kill 9 people. His violence was simply ignored as a, quote, boys will be boys, rhetorically willfully ignorant cop-out to protect that status quo.
That makes me so mad.
A lot of blame all around. He had access to guns. He was toxically masculine asshole. The cops did nothing about his threats. The list goes on. Bottom line, if he had no access to guns, less people would be dead and or in the hospital. F you, Connor Betts. You put my friends and peers' life in danger multiple times in the past. I hope you rot in the body bag they carried you out of this morning. Yeah, a lot of anger. Let's, another one. don't know who the person is, but the news says he was remembered as being bullied, which is interesting because I just remember him as someone who enjoyed making people afraid. Connor seriously threatened to hurt women who rejected him, myself included. Channel says they are avoiding saying his name, but I think we need to talk about how Connor Bretz has been openly talking about doing this for a decade and no one could do anything about it. And he couldn't. In fact, well, in Texas, nobody could do anything to that guy until he started shooting at people. I don't know what it is in Ohio, too. Is Ohio open carry? It is. Same.
That shit makes me so mad, by the way, that boys will be boys shit. Oh, there or this one. He probably just has a crush on you, right? Like, I was told that a number of times by a kid who was psychologically abusing me when I was in school, as if like the fact that there's some like sexual feelings mixed in with it makes it okay for someone to be abusing you.
Right. Well, but they're doing it because they like you.
Like, oh, okay.
Right.
Take it as
Harley Allison Connor Betts is nothing but a case study on how consistently our society fails to call a perpetrator for what they are. He was not bullied. He was a bully. Bully towards women, including myself. A bully toward anyone he deemed below him. I knew Connor for over 10 years. And to pretend that he's ever been any other way, to pretend that he wasn't capable of this level of violence is nothing but willful ignorance. Does a disservice to those he finally had the opportunity to exercise his unearned power over to believe he was ever otherwise. I mean, so here's a lot of people saying, like, yeah, that typical, like, you would have never imagined. Seems to be like, this is exactly what you would imagine. But the bottom line, ultimately, it comes down to the guy's got easy access to guns. And in terms of the number dead, you still have a sickness in society. You still have all these maladies that need to be addressed, but they're not going to get any more or less addressed now. I can tell you that right now. First order is how do you make these attacks less lethal? There's been tons of studies over the years, over decades, about crime levels in the United States. Not necessarily particularly higher or lower than anywhere else, but they're more lethal. So the first thing you deal with is the lethality of our of this stuff. And then you got to deal with the underlying issues that are driving this. And it's a huge mix of stuff. You know how you're not supposed to politicize things? You know, so close to, you're not supposed to talk about guns control after.
Have a little bit of taste.
Let them have the funerals first.
Here's a guest on Fox News, Ted Williams. Who is this guy? And on Fox News, we're not supposed to. This is back when there's only 15 killed in an El Paso shooting. So they didn't get the full amount. So it was quite early in the day on Saturday. And we know we never want to politicize this stuff. Talk about banning guns. Why are you talking about that now? Let's just mourn these folks and ban video games.
You know, I wonder if these guys who very often are raised on a diet of violent video games, if they actually start pulling the trigger of a real weapon and they see real death and they find that it's not as satisfying as maybe it was when they're playing it on a television screen. Have you ever encountered that? And could that be the reason that this guy just finally stopped?
Well, I've encountered video game players and their activity, but it's rare that individuals act out like this that are video gamers. I think it's a little too early to speculate at this stage about the motive. But what we do know is that this guy got a hold to a gun, probably a semi-automatic gun, I would have to believe, because of all of the people that were injured or killed as a result of this shooting. And he specifically targeted this mall. And he specifically targeted it because clearly it was a soft target.
It was a soft target, but we 12 hours later had disproved that theory where we saw a hard target or a target that was so hard that they had the guy killed in 30 seconds. He was still able to kill 9 people. That guy's not the only person who is blaming video games. Kevin McCarthy, who is the Senate majority or minority leader, House minority leader, was on with Maria Bartiromo. And now this is a fascinating clip. One, it's fascinating just because you can't talk about banning guns, you know, which were actually used in these killings. But you can talk about banning video games. Look, I have no particular portfolio for video games.
That's my job.
That's Matt's job. But the absurdity that A, video games can be held responsible for this stuff, but B, that you can ban video games, but not the actual weapons that does the killing, is bizarre. It's bizarre. What's also fascinating about this clip is if you listen to Maria Bartiromo very carefully and you have in your head, because you've watched her with the president a million times, that she is desperate not to criticize the president. But you also have in your head that she hasn't. Again, this is all speculation, conjecture, that she's also aware that the president used almost the identical rhetoric. No, no, no. The identical rhetoric that the president has used showed up in that screed that the killer used. I mean, full sentences. Somebody did, like, you know, you could almost, like, full sentences, the whole, all the concepts, the ideas have all come, if not out of Donald Trump's mouth, Kevin McCarthy's mouth, or any other Republican, frankly. And she knows this, but she can't quite say it. So she's sort of dancing around it a little bit. And it's almost like she's relieved when Kevin McCarthy lands on video games, because that way she can sort of change the topic.
You know, we heard from the deputy governor of Texas earlier, and he was talking. It was a very impassioned conversation, really. And he was talking about the tone that the public uses on social media. He was talking about video games, all of these things that could have triggered. Certainly the video game situation, he was saying, may have triggered the shooter there in El Paso. But what are your thoughts on that in terms of understanding that words matter, and that when we're talking to each other on social media or looking at video games where they're using, you know,
pause it for a second. Like, who do you think she's talking about when we're talking to each other on social media? Like, who's the most famous Twitterer in the world who's using this exact rhetoric that shows up there? Now, the guy doesn't mention anything about video games in his screed. Not a thing about it. He does mention, like, invasion and all the other things.
Immigrants are coming to take my games.
Yeah. But she's, like, sort of, like, trying to open the door. You know, like, you get in that sense, like, she's trying to open the door, but she's not sure where she should tread. So she's going to keep the, like, the emergency hatch open. And let's see which one McCarthy goes for.
Games where they're using, you know, videos of characters with these weapons. Is there a conversation to be had about that, about the tone that this country is using? It's become commonplace to say whatever you want to anybody on social media.
I think we should. And you want to see from these individuals what they wrote in others. But I mean, this may be a place that we could find this ahead of time. There may be a place of what's being written can be changed, can be an indication that an individual needs help and others that we can
pause
stop.
Pause it. If you saw an indication that somebody felt there was an invasion and that the politicians weren't going to do anything about it, how would you know if this was a red flag screed from some potential killer or just the script tonight for Tucker's, you know, now I'm making my point? How would you know the difference?
Change could be an indication that an individual needs help and others that we can stop. But the idea of these video games to dehumanize individuals, to have a game of shooting individuals and others, I've always felt that is a problem for future generations and others. We've watched from studies shown before of what it does to individuals. When you look at these photos of how it took place, you can see the actions within video games and others. But what I'd like to do is make sure just get all the facts where there are indications. And there's times before that we have found this, and there's times before that we've proven we could come together just in the last Congress.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I love about these things? And pardon me for going here. Maybe I'm just being way too cynical. Not only are they not talking about guns, I always now interpret these clips not only as a distraction, but as like the Republican leadership's way of saying, like, video games are actually a really major industry, and you are not spreading your donations around fairly enough at all.
Right. It is amazing that in that conversation, the word guns does not come up.
Not once.
You see the he talks about
the video of the weapons.
He sees the impact of the weapons, but he doesn't say guns. What are we going to do about the guns? That. And they just are ignoring the,
and, you know, there
quite
was also
the pretzel to twist oneself into.
People are so rude on Twitter. They're alienated from each other and they can just say things on Twitter. It's really out there. Yeah, exactly. I agree with that. That's also
Twitter.
Reflected in the dehumanization of video games.
I mean, I don't want to agree that first-person shooters are worse, but I would say Twitter and first-person shooters are different things.
Let's say there's different things. I mean, literally, what's going to happen if the video game industry starts, you know, properly distributing their donations? Where are they going to go next?
However, the Republicans, they know that maybe saying video games or is not going to be enough to justify why this happens. That may not have any salience because they tried that back in the early aughts, and they try it all the time, and it doesn't work out. For a long time, it was the music. Remember, it was, I don't know if you guys knew this, but like when Columbine and other shootings like this, it was heavy metal.
Marilyn Manson.
Yep. It was heavy metal. They were convinced it was the music.
Oh my God, and he's dropping a new album soon. Things are only going to get worse.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Turns out it wasn't the music. It's heavy metal, you know, it's still around. Not so popular as it was at that time.
Well, that's why.
But maybe it's the tone of nameless people on Twitter, you know, that or maybe the governor of Texas has another idea.
Lieutenant governor.
Excuse me, the lieutenant governor of Texas has maybe another idea of what could be responsible for it. Here he is delivering it to the somewhat concerned-looking folks on Fox and Friends weekend.
Sunday morning when most of your viewers right now, half of the country, are getting ready to go to church, and yet tomorrow we won't let our kids even pray in our schools. Mm-hmm. We have to look at ourselves as a nation. It's many factors that go into these shooting, many factors. And it's not a time to politicize.
It's not a time to politicize. It's a time to call for more religion in the schools. First of all, I have some bad news for the lieutenant governor. Half the country's not headed to church.
Yeah, it looks like about 37%.
On Sunday.
That seems high.
Which is higher than I would think.
And I would imagine that's also self-reported.
Yeah.
That could be like how many people go to church once every couple
Easter,
of months.
Easter, yeah, the big ones.
But the idea that this guy's answer to this 20-some-odd year-old individual's killing of all these people is prayer in schools leads me to believe that he does not have like the nimbleness that one would want in a in the thinking of a public official.
Well, this is what I was talking about earlier, right? Like these old institutions were incredibly oppressive to a lot of people, but they did serve a social function of community and cohesion and just keeping people in line. Right. And
yeah. But I mean, let's also be clear that they were keeping people in line. But the church was out there also saying like, oh, incidentally, the savages that that were living here before we are, we're I mean, you can say that they were creating a certain cohesion, but it wasn't necessarily it was just a cohesion that was directed at other people.
Sure. But, and it was incredibly oppressive to people, including, you know, the ones who were in the out group, the ones who were colonized. But if we want to really solve this problem in the long term, we need a new multicultural and secular form of community that can keep us all connected to each other.
I mean, yeah, I think that's a good goal to strive for. But I think if we had less guns, and even if we didn't have the, you know, the cohesion that we would want, et cetera, there'd be less mass killings.
Oh, absolutely.
And less suicides.
I 100% agree with you about that.
Yeah, I would start
like,
for the
cohesion. The forces of the market mediating every human relationship, it's not surprising that people are going to be alienated from each other.
Particularly the one where they can sell guns.
Sure.
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, yeah, start with getting, like, taking on the gun industry, because it's ridiculous that that is an industry, in my opinion. But then you also just expand public education, in my opinion, and shorten the work week, give people more time to go make friends, frankly.
And you know how else people make friends? Like unions. What's union density right now? 10%?
Less.
I think that we have quite a bit of room to grow there. And it is, if you want to talk about a multicultural form of community, unions are some of the most diverse community bodies that exist.
I got to think that dude is going to be, even if union density is at 60%, he's not going to be in the union. Like, I mean, it's possible, but I don't think he's going to be in the union.
The shooter?
Yeah. That's, I get that sense. But yes, that would be a good thing. I'm not sure that would be the most immediate solution to this problem. The most immediate solution to this problem is you got to get rid of it as many as the access to the guns, as many guns. I mean, you got to do it in every single different way that you can. I don't think there's going to be one solution, particularly since the Supreme Court is so problematic. I mean, you need to find like end arounds and side arounds and insurance rates. Make it expensive for people to have guns. Make it super expensive for them. Like, you know, you.
Oh, I also don't believe that obviously the lieutenant governor of Texas is concerned with solving the problem on a systemic long-term level.
No. If it gets people into church, he would.
Working on a new DSA prayer caucus.
So Tim Ryan has exited stage left.
What? Who's he?
Tim Ryan was a guy running for president.
Mm-hmm.
No longer running for president, but good for him. Appreciate the way that he stepped out. Be a great time for Beto to do this.
I go back to Texas, Beto.
Be a great time. Senate. Great time to do it. Here is Tim Ryan on MSNBC Sunday, basically with a piece of parting advice. He's just parting the campaign, not the House. But he has an advice for Republicans. I think it's a good. I think it's a good piece of advice.
Congressman Ryan, you are calling on Congress to cancel the August recess to address gun violence. But how realistic is that? Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, it's time to put public pressure on Mitch McConnell. I'm suspending my campaign for the presidency. I'm going to head back to Ohio, and you know we need leadership right now. And enough is enough. I mean, you watch these videos, and you see Dillard's in the background, and you see Walmart in the background, or you see a church in the background, and no one feels safe anymore. And there is a bottleneck in the United States Senate with Mitch McConnell. We passed in the House of Representatives a few weeks back background checks, a basic step that 90% of the American people support. And the Republicans need to, quite frankly, get their shit together and stop pandering to the NRA because people are getting killed. All those people we saw, and you've been doing this all day long, they had hopes and dreams. They had plans this week. They were going to do things. They were going to meet with their friends. They were going to meet with their family. They were going to go to church. And now they're gone because in this country, we're so dysfunctional that we can't do basic things. And it's got to stop. And we have to put pressure on Mitch McConnell to start with the background check bill. We need an assault weapons ban. We need to study this as a public health crisis that it is. I'll just tell you quickly, I was in Nevada yesterday. Huge shooting in Nevada. How many months back at the concert? I come to campaign in South Carolina, Emmanuel Baptist Church. Now I'm going to go back to Ohio. It's Dayton. It was Chardon. You go to New England and you have Sandy Hook. I mean, this is happening everywhere.
He's right. He's good not. I should just correct myself. He's not withdrawing from the campaign. He's suspending his campaign. He may or may not come back. But, and you know, in light of our guest, Igor Volsky's advice, it would do well for Democratic lawmakers to take that next step. So when they talk about how we're going to put pressure on McConnell, I think our guest was right. We could go there and light ourselves on fire on his doorstep, and he wouldn't care. You've got to actually make his job harder. You need to cause him some inconvenience. And really, Democrats in the Senate are the only ones who have the ability to slow at least part of his agenda. the value of doing a filibuster, even if there is, even if it's on something that I guess procedural, is just that like you're slowing down the amount of time that they have to ram through more judges. One quarter of the federal judiciary, incidentally, now appointed by Trump. One quarter. We are only 3 years through his tenure. These are judges who have lifetime appointments.
So, that's so bad.
So bad.
This is why, okay, one thing that passed this year at the DSA convention that I'm really excited about is the mass strike for reproductive justice resolution. And I've been talking about this for a really long time. We can't rely on the courts to protect our rights. The courts are effed for a long time to come now. So what do we do instead? It's not a plan for a general strike right away. It's a series of escalating direct actions. And maybe the end goal is a general strike, but we're going to need to see more of these kinds of actions as the courts continue to be effed forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are going to have to actually see. I think before we get that in a widespread way, I think we need to see, we need to go through the exercise of lawmakers passing laws that everybody wants and having the court strike them down.
Oh, yeah.
And so that people can understand this, because
I won't vote out of fear.
Exactly. There's too many people out there too stupid to understand, to like do that calculus without actually having to see it happen.
Or if they overturn Roe versus Wade, that's going to be a wake up call for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'd be surprised if they do a head on overturning of Roe v. Wade, as opposed to just sort of like allowing other laws that infringe upon that right to the point of making it useless.
Oh, they will if they can.
They will. Oh, they will overturn it if they can.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Why do you say that with such assuredness? I mean, I think it's possible, but they can right now.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I just feel like they're not. The Republicans always go for the things that they say they're going to do in this arena, right?
Well, no,
they run on.
They've been saying it for 30 years, and they have conveniently appointed judges who didn't do that. I think that they like to string it along. I think we're close to the point where I think we're as close as we, you know, it's really going to be a question of who the next judge is, frankly. I think John Roberts will slow their roll a bit. But if it's 7-3, excuse me, if it's 6-3 in a year or two, I think even John Roberts may not be able to put the brakes on it in the way that he wants to.
I mean, it's true that it matters more that they've been able to chip away at this right through passing laws year after year.
But what I'm suggesting is they're going to diminish the scrutiny that laws that curb a woman's right to choose. So you get trap laws. Like in Texas, they had that law, like, I don't know, your ceilings need to be for abortion clinics need to be 32 feet high on the west side and, you know, 7 feet high on the east side.
Oh, yeah. That's also what I'm talking about.
And, well,
laws, regulations.
Right. And the point being, they don't have to overturn Roe v. Wade to basically make it impossible for you to get an abortion. I mean, we've seen examples of that on a state by state basis, but it could get more egregious.
Oh, I agree. I just think a lot more people will be paying attention if they do overturn Roe versus Wade.
I agree with that.
Might be why they don't do it.
That's probably why they won't do it.
Which is, yes, is my point. They may not do it head on, and they may continue to do it like this.
Well, the time to start the series of escalating direct actions has already passed, so I hope more people start paying attention regardless.
I will second that. Here's our buddy, Charlie Kirk, going on Fox News. I got to be honest with you. I don't know if Charlie Kirk has used the invasion language.
He has.
There you go.
And fact check.
Sorry. I wonder if... Now, Charlie Kirk is going on there. He's going to be talking about why they engage in mass shootings. Is that right?
No, this is about eco-anxiety. We're off the mass shootings sound.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
I thought that was why he was arguing that that's why they engage in that. So he's going to come up with why are these young people, because he's the young person expert, why are these young people engaging in mass shootings? And he can't say, I mean, why is the guy who's afraid of an invasion of immigrants engaging in mass shootings? He can't get up there and say, oh, that guy's doing that because I didn't say there's an invasion enough. He can't say that. He needs to find some other reason. Maybe it's because there's being so much anxiety that young people have. It has nothing to do with college debt. It has nothing to do with living in a situation where they're not going to do as well as their parents.
I remember having anxiety about school shootings when I was in high school.
Well, I mean, let's hear what Charlie Kirk has, why he thinks they're doing it.
One other topic of concern is the environment. So much talk about global warming and climate change and stuff like that. Vogue magazine has a headline, How to Talk to Your Kids About Eco-Anxiety, and they define it as eco-anxiety is a specific type of worry or fear focusing on environmental destruction. It has been at a serious level enough to interfere with their lives.
Pause it for 1 second. Actually, it doesn't say it's been at a serious level. It has to be at a level serious enough to interfere with their lives to be an actual. I mean, because like, look, if you're a 12-year-old kid and you pay attention to even glancing, checking the news, you'll see that like, oh, July was the hottest month in the history of the world. That's not good. But here they're going to mock it maybe on some level. They're going to say it's a fake anxiety. It's been created, manufactured.
What do you make of that? Well, first of all, I really find it hard to believe that there are 5 and 6 year olds that truly have anxiety towards the inevitable alleged destruction of our environment. But if that actually does exist, then isn't it the people on the left that are saying the world's going to end in 12 years? It's their fault that these children actually have this anxiety, if it is true. Isn't it the people that are saying we only have 10 years left to live? Again, this is something that is just so based in fear mongering and demagoguery. The idea that children are having some sort of anxiety that the world is going to end in 10 to 12 years, which is anti-science and is just not true whatsoever. But they're again, you look at the left, look what they're trying to do. They're trying to make it seem, well, it's for the children, why we need some sort of Green New Deal or more government control over our economy.
Charlie, there's no doubt kids have worries and anxiety. I mean, just last night, one of my boys was worried about whether he'd be on the team with the other two boys in basketball camp this morning. Yeah, but it's not just families. It's schools are reinforcing this eco-anxiety, mm-hmm. too, by being obsessed with climate change.
That's exactly right. And unfortunately, this is a really important point. Elementary school children spend much more time focusing on climate change and the environment than they do on American history. You'll have 4th and 5th graders that will know much more about.
Pause it for 1 second. I cannot tell you how many times the right has complained about actual American history being taught to people.
Well, Charlie kind of hints at what kind of American history he wants to
talk. Yeah, the good kind of American history.
American history. You'll have 4th and 5th graders that will know much more about the idea that the world will end in 10 years than about 1776, the War of 1812, the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, or the beauty of the American founding. And that right there can answer the question of how these radical ideas are actually able to spread in our society when you spend far more time on the idea that the world is going to end in 10 years, which is totally false, and not on the history of our country.
All right, so he's not bringing it up in the context of the shooting. Okay.
That's a great segment.
The idea kids, that fourth graders or fifth graders, now Charlie doesn't get this because I mean, this is a problem you have when I think you're Charlie's age is you don't remember what you knew at that age and you haven't had your memory refreshed by hanging out with people that age, which is probably a good thing that he's not. But having had a recent 4th and 5th grader and expecting another one to be a 4th and 5th grader in about 4 or 5 years. I can tell you that they, do things like read the internet and see the reports and study things called natural science. And if you're teaching science and you're not talking about global climate change, then you're not doing your job.
Yeah, you're not teaching science.
Now, what's interesting, though, is that Charlie does understand the implications of fear-mongering. Like, for instance, if you told everybody, let's say you went and told a group of kids who are in fifth grade, there's an invasion going on. We're being invaded. I suspect that they would freak out. Here he is. Charlie Kirk, well, to be fair, this is 7 months ago. Liberal hypocrisy, he writes. Tear gas was used at least once a month from 2009 to 2013 to deter immigrants at the southern border under the Obama administration. The left is outraged when our Border Patrol agents protect our country from a violent invasion, but only if Trump is president. Well, on some level, certainly the use of tear gas, it wasn't used in the exact same way, but the use of tear gas was certainly something that people should have been pissed about. Of course, I don't remember Charlie Kirk praising Obama for using tear gas.
And plenty of people on the left were outraged by both of those things.
Yes. But the idea that we're involved in a violent invasion, I think Charlie has figured out probably why some people are inspired to commit those domestic terrorist attacks. Inadvertently, he may have.
I agree with him that we should teach, American history more in schools. For instance, like about that founding of the country that was so beautiful. For instance, who would have the slaves preferred to have won that war? Not America.
And then, you know, as long as we're doing the Civil War, we could do Reconstruction, and we could do the end of we could do Jim Crow. That would be fun to hear about.
Well, don't go overboard. You don't want to make the kid look. They're anxious enough about basketball tryouts, bro.
They want to know about structural racism.
They
want to
know about structure. I mean, they want to know about the plantation economy. They want to know whether they're going to be able to
pitch
or not.
They don't want to know about slavery capitalism.
I mean, basketball is winter. What about spring sports?
You're going to bring Sven Becker into them? Jesus talk about
Christ.
Slavery and capitalism?
That would sit down and you listen, kids.
That would be awesome.
We're going to take some time to understand that our country is fundamentally diseased, but then the other part is going to be that your world isn't going to exist. So Daddy would like to apologize for bringing you into this world, which is going to end so
I've
soon.
I've said that so many times.
Do you see? As you pick them up in your arms and they're babies, go, oh, I'm so sorry. If you're lucky, they won't raid the Social Security Trust Fund.
I did
Misery loves company.
I did specifically tell them, like, Daddy's going to be a little bit annoying. I'm giving you a heads up right now. And if you don't like it, then you're going to have to figure out some other way to survive.
My way or the Long Island Expressway.
Exactly.
Do you see?
Here is Pat McCrory. He is the former governor of North Carolina. Remember, this guy was so bad that upon losing, this is clip number 10, upon losing his election, he basically, the Republicans in the state legislature passed a law saying that the Democrat who preceded him, or succeeded him, I should say, was not allowed to really do anything. They tried the same thing in Wisconsin, too. Pretty stunning. I'm having trouble getting on to the call-in system. It's not showing up and showing the... it's weird. Here is... Pat McCrory. No, here's Pat McCrory trying to explain that there's not. It's not. You know, this is. It's not just. It's not just Hamas, and it's not just
the lack of prayer in schools.
Yeah. Pat McCrory, can you defend any of this? Of the president's words and statements and his. Do you believe he's contributed to this toxic brew, as it was described?
I disagree with Cory Booker. I agree with the comment made that I don't think you blame a politician. You blame the person who did it. You know, I blamed Oswald. I blamed Brenner. I blamed James Earl Ray. I blamed Hinckley. I blamed a haunting Charles Whitman, who, when I was a small kid in elementary school, went to a tower and shot students from a tower in Austin, Texas. I didn't blame Lyndon Baines Johnson at the time. But there is no doubt that the president has to come out with a strong statement against, listen, there are some white nationalist nuts and dangerous people out there, including my state, that need to be called out. Radicals, and by the way, Antifa nuts that attacked my car just blocks from here in a taxi cab and during the inauguration and jumped on my hood with hoods on them. We have to call out radical left-wing groups and not give them any credibility whatsoever.
Well, wait a second. So he started with, I blame the people that do it, and now he's going around to upset that we're not calling out Antifa for jumping on his car?
Did the full 180 by the end of that statement there.
I would find out who the individuals were who did that and Look, blame them.
It reminds you of that.
Excuse me, sir.
The Bill O'Reilly saying to Dennis Miller, like, Hitler was such an idiot. Like, what really upsets McCrory here is that this justifies Antifa's, Antifa action, basically.
Hitler was an idiot. Guy was a total moron.
You play right into there.
You know, the whole point of Hitler, if Hitler wasn't so brazen, we wouldn't have had decades of Jews whining. And I heard that right, Miller?
Well, he's applying a double standard, right?
Is that okay? So Jews are already annoying enough to begin with, Miller. Then Hitler comes along, totally
idiot,
such an idiot, balls out, no maturity, no strategy,
and now taking out all comers.
Steven Spielberg dining off of it forever. Am I right, Miller?
Let's just play this one clip. This is I like to see this. Because there is at least, you know, some pushback in our society. And I like the fact that, I mean, soccer's always been probably the most political of all sports because of the nature of the countries that have, you know, had it as a national pastime to the extent that we could say that have been more political than, you know, the countries that, let's say, have baseball per se. It's catching on, and I like it, you know, even in, the context of a U.S. soccer. Here is, Alejandro Bedoya. He plays for Philadelphia Union, and he scored a goal against the, DC United. And watch what he does. He runs over to a mic.
Down left, and Bedoya shot off the post and in, and the Union take the early lead. In the third minute, the captain comes up with a very big goal.
Hey, Congress, do something now. End gun violence. Let's go.
Down left at Bedoya.
He runs over to the microphone. They put microphones on the field.
To get the ambient field sound.
Yeah, that gets the field sound. Yeah. That's nice. Amazing.
And he runs over. He sees the microphone. And it was weird, too, because like all his right there. No, right before that. Go back. All these guys start running back onto the field, and he's like, he goes right for the microphone. He goes the completely other direction. Looks like he's running off. He's running, like, you know, back to the locker room.
Way to politicize.
In the third minute, the captain comes up with a very big goal.
Hey, Congress, do something now. End gun violence. Let's go.
Mic drop.
That's pretty awesome.
Miller, did you anticipate him politicizing this gay Eurosport like that?
Call from a 415 area code. 415? Calling from a 415 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 415? That's the thing, is I don't know if I'm actually even logged into the system. I think I am, but...
Kyle.
Calling from an 803 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Dustin from South Carolina.
Justin, what's on your mind?
It's going to be a little bit off topic for today, but it's something. probably one of the most enraging stories of the last year for me. This August 9th will mark, sorry, I'm a little nervous. I don't know why, but I'll try to push through it.
You're doing great.
August 9th will mark 1 year since the school bus bombing in Yemen last year.
Yep.
You might remember that story. It was kind of like a blip on the radar, and that kind of, that's been something that's kind of pissed me off, actually.
That,
and I was just hoping that people would just, you know, remember that and maybe use this anniversary, if you want to call it that, as a way to pressure 2020 candidates, ask them what our relationship with Saudi Arabia should be. I don't know. I think we should just end the alliance. I don't want war or anything, of course, but, you know, that needs to be a conversation, I think.
I think, you know, at the very least, obviously, there's been some activity on it. You know, the Congress, Sanders and Ro Khanna, they introduced bills that would inhibit our providing weaponry and material support for the Saudis. In the war against Yemen. I mean, it is, you can't surpass the veto, but yes, I mean, I hope that foreign policy comes up in some of these debates. I imagine it will. It will, if only because Joe Biden, there's a perception that Joe Biden is an old foreign policy hand. And so I find it hard to believe that we're not going to see the establishment media sort of try and play into that. It's going to be an interesting exchange.
United States should talk with the Houthis directly. You know, again, this is just, you don't have to be pro-Houthi or whatever, but the whole mythology that the Houthis are just an Iranian proxy is not true. And there's clearly a lot of organic support for them, or they wouldn't have still, I mean, one of the kind of things, first and foremost, obviously, is the genocide that's taking place in Yemen, backed by us and the UK, but how resilient the Houthis are. I mean, the Houthis have been able to still be fighting and claiming territory with all of this artillery against them. And it has so many, I mean, this is a part of the Sudan story. The actual ground troops that are fighting for the Saudis are Sudanese troops. And, I mean, Sam's right, though. There has been a lot of work in Congress, and it's not enough to override a veto. And that's because of the Saudi lobby, and it's also because of the arms lobby. Raytheon and other companies are making a killing out of this.
But we will we'll make sure we try and remember that on Friday.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call.
I had one other thing I wanted to a date coming up this week that I think is important to remember, if I could.
Sure.
August 7th, that's my birthday for one, but more importantly, that is the release date for Centoya Brown. So, a celebration on one hand, but also remember the injustice that was done there. And that's all.
All right. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
My daughter's birthday is the 9th. Centoya Brown was, the woman who she killed, I think she killed, was it like a John who was abusing? I'm not 100% sure.
I think it was a pimp, but I got to double check.
Yeah. She was like 16, I think, at the time. Not terribly familiar.
Oh yeah, it was a client.
Calling from an 818 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey Sam, long time no see. Dave from Jamaica here.
Dave from Jamaica.
Hey Marco.
Long time no hear from, really. I mean, maybe you haven't seen me in a while. How are you, Dave?
I'm not doing too bad. News is depressing as usual, but yeah. I guess what I was talking about, while we all agree that there should be gun reform. But the thing is, it almost seems like you'll have to have like a ton of societal changes just to get to the gun reform, because it's just not people's number one issue.
Yeah.
Sadly enough.
I mean, I think, I think that's my point about you know, you're not going to get serious gun reform until you sort of deal with all the other impediments to any decent legislation, which is the existence of Republicans in positions of power, frankly.
Right. Because, I mean, think about it. Newtown happened. And if that didn't move people, I hate to be pessimistic. I don't think nothing will.
No, I hear you, Dave.
I think it'll be easier to get. I think we're talking to Discord. And I think Kentucky Fried Comrade said it. It'll probably get more movement on climate change than you get on gun reform. But yeah. I think people still need to focus on the real core issues. Cornel West talks about it a lot too. We have to figure out to deal with this alienation. And we also have to realize that, because I've shot guns before, there is an addictive quality to guns, because
they're,
I know a few gun nuts.
They're fun.
It's fun. I mean, and it is an illusion of power, like, because they feel like they're powerful. And because I've talked to gun nuts and they're telling me every scenario about, well, if somebody's going to break in the house, I'm always situationally aware. And, you know, like they're in some sort of bad Chuck Norris movie. But once you can dispel that illusion, that might be one key step. But well, I don't know.
But well, you know what? You can't dispel that illusion. You can't. I mean, like, there's no program where we're going to go to all these individuals. I mean, look, upstate, all my neighbors had guns. Some had guns that they, you know, made. Like, they'd get an apple tree and they'd build the butt, and it was like a two or three, and it was all about gun safety, and it ranged from there through to people who are like, I just have a range in my backyard with a handgun just because it's fun. And there's nobody else around here, and I keep the gun locked up, to, you know, somebody who was like, I got a shotgun and I got a AR-15. I'm like, what's the AR-15 for? Zombies. You know, somebody's telling me, like, they've buried an unregistered handgun in the woods. And I'm like, what? Why? Well, I mean, if they come and get me, like, what? Who's coming to get you that a handgun buried in the woods is going to save you? Like, if this apocalypse,
like, I'm going to give you enough time.
Well, it's just like, the government. And I'm like, dude, if the government comes to get you, it's going to take, you wouldn't stop them if you had a tank. Right? Like, it'd just be a matter of time. They're going to get you.
Well, look, we also have to remember, like with many issues, the will of the American populace is not being reflected by our elected government. Like, I just looked up this poll on Reuters from this year that says 69% of Americans, including 85% of Democrats and 57% of Republicans, want strong or moderate restrictions placed on firearms.
Well, yeah, but that's the way I started this conversation. And what David said, too, is that you can look at those people and where they rank, how they vote, is not contingent upon those numbers. They don't put gun control high enough on their measure when they go and pull a lever. So particularly with those Republicans, most of the Democrats, all of the people that they're going to vote for are already for gun control. But out of that 57% of Republicans, I bet maybe not even 5 or 10% would vote on, you know, would insist that their candidate be for gun control, or they're not going to vote for him. That's the problem. Right there in a nutshell. And so you just need to defeat Republicans. Because the problem is that the 33% or 43% of Republicans who are not for gun control, that's their number one, number two voting thing. Because guns represents a whole lot of other things. It's a surrogate for a whole lot. Because I can tell you that right now, like, the people that, the guys you're talking to who think they're Chuck Norris or whatever it is. What color do you think the people who are invading their home are in their mind?
Isn't Jamaica? I'd almost say if they're probably browner than a brown paper bag.
Right.
So. Well, we also got to look at the other side of the coin, the other info
press
from the poll.
Press one if Republicans are bad.
Which is that only 14% said that they were very confident their representatives understood their views on firearms, and just 8% felt very confident that they were going to do anything about it. So maybe if nobody believes that their representatives are ever going to do anything about it, it makes sense that it wouldn't be at the top of their list.
Well, I mean, I guess.
Well, I do agree with there's a bit of hopelessness thing kicked in. But there is also, I think, unfortunately, there's a saying, you know, certain people don't learn till they feel. So unless they kind of experience that tragedy personally, then it kind of lights a fire under their ass. Because outside of that, it's still not their number one issue.
I like, got to tell you, I
I've
think
seen
that
people
we
get
to
motivated over all sorts of bullshit. So I don't know.
Well, I appreciate the call, Dave.
Oh, I'm just happy to drop some ideas to everybody. So catch you guys later.
Got a rare appearance. That is a regular segment on TMBS. Jamaican Dave Rubin.
Jamaica's best Dave Rubin impersonator.
Jamaica's best Dave Rubin impersonator.
Calling from a 210 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Good afternoon, Sam. It's John from San Antonio.
John from San Antonio.
Yeah, Bernie gave a stellar performance at last Tuesday night's debate, promoting his agenda of helping working and middle-class voters. I was also impressed by Warren's commitment in defense of Medicare for All. Their performance should have moved the polls, but I'm not seeing much movement. Dave Weigel explained in a tweet he put out on Saturday, you can't write the same story every week, but the electability question runs everything. 80% plus of Democrats like Biden, Warren, and Sanders, and many of them, if told that Biden had a 90% chance of winning, but the others had a 70% chance, would stick with Biden. So this analysis is in line with the last YouGov polling, which asked the question, thinking about the Democratic Party's nominee for president in 2020, which is more important to you, a nominee who agrees with your position on issues, which only gets 37%, or a nominee who can win the general election in November, which gets 63%. Voters age 18 to 29 have a plus 6 on issues, 53 to 47, 30 to 44 have a 6% advantage on electability. Voters age 45 to 64 have a plus 50 or a 3-to-1 advantage on electability, and voters 65 and older have a plus 52 advantage on electability. Now, in the latest NBC poll conducted by Hart Research,
I'm sorry, but John, I'm not. Explain that to me. What do you mean by advantage on electability? Okay, they're more interested in electability.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So I mean, basically, this is all being driven by older voters, is the point.
And
the
they support they're most supportive of Biden and then Warren.
Yeah. That's true. Right. I mean, you know, Harris had some support, you know, after the first debate, but that kind of evaporated. So anyway, on this NBC poll, they had the same question, and it's actually 51 to 45 as far as the issues. And so the difference is, one is an internet poll who participates. You know, participants want to have the voice their opinion and are willing to take in a significant amount of time to answer the over 100 questions. And the NBC poll is an old school phone poll that uses a majority of cell phone only calls. So this method was very effective at picking races close to the election time. You know, in Senate races in the 21st century, leading aggregators pick the winners in 95% of the races, with a slightly higher number for states in presidential elections over the same period. But all everyone remembers lately are the 5 states that almost all the aggregators got wrong in 2016. The uncertainty in polling is because of the emergence of the smartphone and the fact that younger voters still don't answer their phones from a number they don't know. I enjoyed your take on the Scarborough's ridiculous take on electability that you addressed in a clip called Morning Joe Forgets He Loved Trump Before 2006. The former Clinton campaign operative Jen Palmieri epitomizes the delusion of many Democratic voters when she said on MSNBC, they're using issues to attack each other's character and record. I didn't hear any character attacks in either debate. And that's what's the point of having debate if you can't point out differences in policy?
Well, I think Biden's character, I got to be honest with you, I think Biden's character was a little bit assaulted insofar as the idea was that, and I would say that they didn't, that the busing issue was an attempt to point out a narrative with Joe Biden, which is that, he didn't have a problem in retrospect, even more, I think, most importantly, with having to deal with segregationists back at the time. He was bragging about it. And I think that is, I think that's a character flaw, frankly. But your mileage may vary in some ways. But I also think the idea that, like, you bring up issues to attack people's records. Yeah. I don't know what else is supposed to happen in a political campaign.
Well, that's the point, that nobody actually wants to talk about issues. I mean, the whole, you know, pushback the next day, you know, by the mainstream media was just basically saying that we can't talk about issues. The only thing that's important is electability. And you saw it. I mean, like the night that you were on MSNBC, that first section, that was one of the worst things I've ever seen in any Chris Hayes segment. I mean, they had Jonathan Alter on, they had Ayushi Moody Mills, and they were just talking about how can Democrats attack each other. And I'm just like, what? I mean, they're just so delusional about, you know, the whole idea of having a primary. I mean, I just don't understand it.
Well,
I've never seen anything.
I'll tell you why I can help you understand it. If you want the front runner to win, the first thing you say is like, hey, why is everybody attacking everybody? Right? I mean, it's like this. It's like, you know, you run one quarter of the race, you're ahead by 30 yards, and you turn around and you go, hey, wait a second. I have an idea. Why don't we stop running? We're just going to walk. Let's just walk, because you were starting to get winded a little bit. So we're just going to walk. Let's walk the rest of the way. Why are we getting so caught up in the running? I mean, the idea is that they don't, the more attacking on issues, the less their less favored candidates will win. In many respects.
I'm yet to hear any of the candidates Obama.
I thought that was about attacking Obama, not so much each other. People want to maintain the Obama legacy, and I understand why they want to do that. But the fact of the matter is, it wasn't very good. I mean, he's a great guy, I think, you know, as it's in terms of like, if I could construct a president, I would want that president to have like his grace, his demeanor, his, you know, ability to smile, you know, like all those things, like all the sort of like very superficial things so that I could show my kid, you know, like, look at the president. She's a great person. Look at the president. He's a great person. But from a like a political perspective, they messed up a lot of things. And in some instances, they, you know, why they messed it up, there's a couple of different theories. It really, you know, maybe it's less relevant now looking back on why they messed up as much as how they messed up, because I don't know what's in Barack Obama's mind. I suspect it was because, you know, he just had a specific ideology that would also made him rather timid. But the stimulus wasn't big enough. Everybody knew it. They knew it at the time, at least from a data perspective, but they were afraid politically to go forward. They were overconfident about a lot of aspects of Obamacare. They oversold the affordability aspect of it and didn't focus on just the regulatory aspect of it. Recall, that if John McCain had died 6 months earlier, there would be no Obama legacy. All you'd have is no health care plan and an anemic recovery that took too long and brought about, you know, arguably opened the door for a Donald Trump, a foreclosure regime that was horrific for millions of Americans. You lost 1,000 races over the course of those years, particularly in a devastating fashion in 2010, after Obama specifically said to the caucus, "I got this. Don't worry about it." The Obama people shut down OFA going into when they won. They did not want any outside pressure. They did not want any outside groups. They wanted to play strictly an inside game. They cut off funding to outside groups that weren't affiliated with them in any way. I mean, there's a lot of things that Obama did wrong, and I think it's silly to say that the candidates shouldn't argue about it. If they want to, look, here's the bottom line. If they think it's such a bad idea to attack Obama's legacy because it's going to alienate them from voters, then just, you know, whatever. I mean, I happen to think from a strategic standpoint, I wouldn't have done it the way that most of those candidates did it. On the second night, I thought that what Cory Booker was doing was pretty good, saying you don't know about these issues. If I was Kamala Harris, I would have basically said, I'm curious about why you think you can deal with Mitch McConnell better than Barack Obama did, and tease that out a little bit. Because if Joe Biden has to start explaining those things, it's going to make him look either completely clueless or maybe just think, what?
What could he possibly say that isn't like very damaging to him there?
Nothing.
Yeah.
In my estimation. Or it's certainly, if he figures out something, he's a better politician than I give him credit for. Appreciate the call,
John. If you're talking about, right, but can I make one more point? If you're talking about Medicare for all, don't you have to address, you know, the fact that Obamacare was not sufficient? I mean, that has to be addressed. There's no choice in that.
You know what? But you don't even have to frame it that way. Here's how I would frame it. Everyone knew the Affordable Care Act was the first step. We had plans for a public option. Even Barack Obama said that if he had to do it over again, he would do Medicare for all. He said in 2018, is that what this is? In 2018, that Medicare for all is a good idea. We all knew that Affordable Care Act was the first place. We had no idea that the Supreme Court would say no to millions of people on Medicaid. We're never going to get that back. Now we build on the Affordable Care Act. Here he is in September 2018.
It's harder for young people to save for a rainy day, let alone retirement. So Democrats aren't just running on good old ideas like a higher minimum wage. They're running on good new ideas like Medicare for all.
Real dope.
Giving workers seats on corporate boards.
All right, there it is. I mean, there's room to... Here's the thing. People already have an idea at this point about their health insurance and about the Affordable Care Act. When you are trying to communicate to people who have disparate views on things, some people might like certain aspects of their health insurance. They might want it cheaper. They might want there to be less hassles, but they're also comparing it to their neighbor and they're like, I'm actually doing okay. Like, I can get 75% of my doctor's visit taken care of, or 80% taken care of. I'm doing okay. Would I rather 100% take care of? Yeah. Would I rather not have the things? But that's not really necessarily the question that they're answering. The point is, rather than tell people something that they have beliefs on, you can leverage those beliefs. Nobody's going to be up there going like, no one, let me put it this way. Nobody who thinks that the Affordable Care Act is not sufficient or that their health insurance sucks is going to complain that you're offering another solution, right? Nobody's going to do that. The people who might feel married to the Affordable Care Act because they got attached to it because it was being attacked by the Republicans, they don't want to lose what they have, or they don't realize that, like, oh, this stuff with, like, all the things that made the insurance actually viable and decent, that's still going to exist in a Medicare for all. Like, for us, that's obvious. But I don't know that it's obvious to everybody.
Especially considering most people have not had to buy insurance on the exchanges.
Most people have no idea what the experience of Obamacare is. When they hear Obamacare, what they hear is, I don't have shitty insurance anymore. Price is still going up, but it's not crappy insurance. And I can't get rejected if I have a pre-existing condition. And my colonoscopy is free. My birth control is free. That's what they hear when they hear the Affordable Care Act for the overwhelming number of people in the country. So there's no point in my, I mean, if I was advising somebody, I would say the Affordable Care Act was a good first step, even if I believed it wasn't a great first step, because it's already happened. And why should I go back and litigate the past if I'm really basically saying, but we can now, it sets us up to do something even better. And we will always, always thank President Obama for setting us up to have Medicare for all. Thank you, Obama. That's the way I would do it. And that's probably the way I'll do it against Chuck Schumer, if that happens. All right, I got to go, John. Thanks.
Okay. One other thing real quick. You read numbers from on the second night of the debate on Friday and on Ring of Fire. Where are those numbers coming from?
What the about who supports them?
Percentage of
I don't know. I
got to
find that document. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Okay. All right. Fair
John's
enough.
Getting bold.
He wanted those
John
numbers.
John is always out alpha'd Sam.
He's the ombudsman.
Just, I mean, look. It's one thing for him to clearly be the alpha of the relationship, but like you got to just have some respect of the format.
I got no problem for that. I got no problem.
I have no problem submitting to right. John.
I don't. I can
I'm
handle
John's
it.
Bottom. That's
I can,
fine.
I can handle it.
Do you see? I like it. It's my version of no exit listening to you guys talk about polls.
Calling from a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling
just kidding.
From?
I love John.
Hey, Sam. This is Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. How are you, sir?
Good. I keep thinking about how, as a Majority Report correspondent, I went to a Dave Rubin show about a year ago. Remember
right.
that?
Yeah, I do remember it. Yeah.
Dave brought up this guy onto the stage who doesn't have any hair. He has some sort of disorder where he has no hair. And this guy had been at a Patriot Prayer rally, and a leftist called him a skinhead. And there was a video that kind of went viral, and the whole thing was that the left is so intolerant that they just assumed that this poor guy with a disorder was a skinhead, and like, how, you know, that's of course serious oppression, right?
I seem to remember that controversy. Yes.
Yeah. So I came home and I looked up the guy, and he's got a YouTube channel, and it's like him and some of his college friends complaining about how hard it is to be like right wing in college or at the university, you know? And then like in one of the episodes, one of his friends is talking about how he just got back from France, which is like a total hellhole now because of the immigrants.
Right.
And this same guy who was like so offended that he was called a skinhead suggests that like it's not at all unreasonable that a European nation should be able to declare themselves a white ethno state. And so, and then they talk about how
he has
you know, Japan is really great because it's a monoculture and all these things. So basically, like you know, Dave Rubin is like really obsessed with you know protecting these people. And putting out this idea that the worst thing in the world is to be called a racist, while the more private they get, like the deeper into 8chan or 4chan or whatever those things are, the truth starts to come out. And then I decided recently to find out where Dave Rubin stands on immigration, because at the show, he said he was pro-amnesty and thought that the wall was a dumb idea. But I found some interviews where recently he's been complaining or, you know, what his big concern is assimilation and pointing out, just like these, you know, college douchebags on their little YouTube channel, pointing out that Europe has had all of these problems because of immigration and the failure to assimilate. And I think that it's going to be important for us to learn, not us, because obviously we're super woke and we totally get it, but for people to understand what it means to be racist. It's not just like shouting the N-word and being overtly racist.
How can he be racist sort of, if he likes Japan?
Yeah, exactly. It's these, you know, these sorts of cultural concerns and things like that. I think you do a good job of covering that, but I just...
Well, I like, you know, it feels like there needs to be another word, like racism or something like that, so that when they say, like, you calling me racist, I'm not racist. I didn't call you racist, sir. I called you racist. How's that different?
Yeah,
well, that's just like when you quietly espouse racism. So you're not the type of person who's going to go burn a cross on the on someone's lawn. I mean, that's the problem, is that like the threshold that racism does, a racist really does cover someone who would go and lynch someone because they're black through making these type of arguments. And frankly, you know, even I think on some level, just sort of like, you know, living some type of practice of white supremacy. You know, it describes this whole, you know, it's a wide range of perspectives. I'm not saying that any of them are legitimate, but it does cover a wide range of perspectives. And I think the polite racism is just as nefarious. Well, I mean, it's not quite as nefarious, but it obviously does get people killed.
The thing is, I think it's only polite oftentimes because they're savvy enough to know that it's a dance that they're doing. It's not that they're, you know,
well,
they're actually
they've convinced themselves. They've convinced themselves that it's you know, they wouldn't say that they're racist. I think even they would just say, like, look, I'm not racist. I'm just looking at the reality that we're better. And I think it would be helpful, but we, you know, it's not going to happen, obviously, but it would be helpful to have another term that is like, that can cover those people so that we can communicate, you're racist, but we will acknowledge that you also are not burning a cross.
Yeah.
I understand you don't identify as a racist. However,
well, I just think it could be fair to say, like, now I gotta give it up. I'm got to admit, you're a non-cross burning racist. You're not a cross burning racist. You know, I mean, if there was a way of saying that.
Sure. I mean, we also need to work to identify and expose the racism underlying these attitudes, right? Because, like,
well, yes,
in some ways, the alt-light is maybe more dangerous than the hard right, because someone like Richard Spencer, like an out and proud white nationalist, is never going to be accepted in mainstream circles. But people who couch their arguments and concerns about culture, like, say, Gavin McInnes or Tucker Carlson, are going to be given bigger platforms and reach more people.
Right. And just like you say, alt-light instead of alt-right, it's helpful to have a term. It would be helpful to have a term, but we don't have it. So we just have this.
Let me ask you one more thing. Do you think it would be more useful? I mean, it's very, it feels very futile to even have this conversation, but to focus on sort of like a licensing structure for guns and rather than the type of guns, because I do hear certain right-wing arguments about, like, you know, Virginia Tech, the shooter at Virginia Tech was using handguns.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think the left gets bogged down in details that, frankly, the right is correct about that don't really matter.
If I couldn't go for the whole kit and caboodle, I would do it like this. Rather than putting, you need to take a test and you need to get a license, and there are thresholds in the license and what you can own. So that one individual could theoretically own it all, but they would have to be extremely well vetted. Do you follow me?
Like you and me.
Right. Yeah. Like you and I. Like we, you know, you can show us. Look, I can go to your home, right? I mean, if you get a life insurance, they come and they take your blood, they take your medical records, they give you an examination. Well, if you want to get a license or to get a gun, you also need a certain amount of insurance. Let's say, you know, maybe if we can incentivize people to make it a cash business in this instance. To get a certain license to carry, let's say you want an AR-15. Okay. You need a Class 4 license. To qualify for a Class 4 license, you have to have a visit to your home by an insurance company. That insurance company has to issue the insurance. They will determine, you know, your gun safety protocols, your training, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and do it that way. Like that.
Even the waiting times, like, I had a fellow student in law school who went and bought a gun and committed suicide the same day. And the El Paso shooter seemed to indicate that he was in a rush to do it because he was afraid of losing his nerve. And so you do wonder, you know, it's a
waiting
small
times.
Thing, but...
Who did we just talk to about that with suicides? The decision's made within the first hour. Yeah, Jonathan Metzl. Yeah.
Thanks for taking my call, Sam.
Thanks, Ronnie. Yeah. I mean, that was all that if you want to stop like those 20,000-30,000 suicides annually by guns, you make it harder for people to have guns that quickly. So if you've already, but you could do it this way where like if you already have a Class 4 license, I'm making this up, and you're fully insured, you don't have a waiting period. You don't make it per gun. You make it per the person. It's just one potential suggestion. I mean, personally for me, I would just like, psh, no handguns, no semi-automatics, hunting stuff only, sport shooting. If you want to shoot a handgun, got to be locked up at the range. Boom. That's it. And if you want, you have the range. You can use a bazooka too. Got to be locked up at the range. All right, final call of the day, ladies and gentlemen. Calling from a 602 area code. Who is this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Ryan from New Hampshire.
Ryan from New Hampshire. I don't know what device you're talking on, but you should try and talk on it closer.
Okay. I mainly just wanted to say I hate the phrase common sense gun control.
Yeah.
I think it alienates anyone that disagrees with you. It also, I feel like it doesn't give enough factor of how hard any kind of meaningful gun control is going to be. Every time I hear it on the news, it triggers me. I just feel like it's just
let me ask you this, Ryan. Does the term common sense gun control scare you more than the idea of maybe sending your kid to school and getting a shot in a shooting?
I just feel like it's think there's going to be this easy legislation that's going to pass, it's going to fix everything. But
no,
it's going to be extremely hard to fix anything.
No, I think you're wait. There's no point in you just talking over there so that I can't hear him. I mean, if you have something to add, add it, but talking to yourself over there. If you need to go, go. But I can't even hear what he's saying. So what's your point? Do you think that people think there's going to be one, forgive the pun, silver bullet?
Exactly. And it's just a talking point that kind of stops actual discussion of possible policies.
Well,
everyone thinks there's just common sense that's going to fix things.
Well, you're not really telling me anything. I can't quite figure out what you're saying. The obstacles to a common sense gun control. And I think common sense is a term that, like, if you have 70% of the population agreeing on certain provisions, I think that's a safe way of saying common sense. Now, like I say, it's not intensely held by them in terms of how they vote, and that's why I don't think you see it. But I'm not sure, like, I'm not sure what you're saying. I mean,
yeah,
so
just because something's common sense to most people doesn't mean that it's easy to put it into practice politically. Those are two different things.
I think there is a sense that if we did just background checks, that that would be enough, or something else, that that would be enough. And I think what happens is we keep learning, you know, how you do this and where the constraints are by the Supreme Court.
I mean, I think that's a big part of it too. But like personally, I think background checks would accomplish almost nothing. So I don't know. It just makes it feel like I don't have common sense because I don't think background checks would be effective. Like most
like,
guns
well, you
don't
think
background checks already.
Well, but you don't think background checks would be effective. Why?
I mean, right now, any gun you buy at any retail location, there's a background check already. It's just private sales, which is a tiny percentage. It's just...
Is there a waiting period? Is there a waiting period?
That depends on the state.
Excuse me? Yeah.
Waiting period is state to state.
Okay, so why would we need background checks if we already have them?
Right, I don't see why you would.
Right, so who's calling for background checks?
Well, people say universal background checks because they want to end private sale loopholes, which is a minuscule amount of gun sales.
Right, okay, so but that's not a bad thing. You just don't think it's sufficient. We need to do more.
I don't think it changes.
Well, I mean, it must change. It must change something. I mean, this guy who bought the gun in Dayton, Ohio, bought it through a mail order in Texas, a dealer in Texas. I mean, so it would have made it a little bit harder for him, maybe.
And if you get a gun through the mail, you have to go to a local federal license and pass a background check. So he passed a background check.
Okay. All right. Well, so... Closing the private sales loophole is not sufficient, but there's no reason not to do it, right?
I mean, it's completely unenforceable unless you have a gun registry.
Okay, it's unenforceable. It's only going to help maybe on the margins, but there's no reason not to do it, right?
There might be some reasons.
Okay.
Like if I want to give my kid a gun for Christmas and he's 14, do I have to give him a background check? Because that's a private sale, technically.
Okay. Here's the deal.
Is that what we want?
I think part of that background check should be you're older than 14.
Okay, so I give my dad a Christmas present. Do I have to give him a background check?
Well, did you get it? Yeah, I think you did, of course. I mean, you can't go buy booze for your 14-year-old kid.
Well, I can buy booze for my dad.
Okay, so you can buy it for your dad, but their requirements on your dad are that he's not somebody who has a record of, let's say, domestic violence, or he's not a felon.
Okay, but and again, if there's no gun registry.
All right, so let's say your dad's a felon. Okay, I'm just picking this out of the air, right? Something that would prevent him from getting a gun on a background check. Do you think that he should not have to go through a background check? Because
so right now,
just
because
you want to give him a gun?
I give him a gun and I know he's a felon, that's already illegal.
Oh my God. Well, how do we know that? How do we know that?
What do you mean?
How does society know that you've broken the law?
How do they know if I just hand them a gun in a Christmas present?
Oh my God. Wow. I don't understand what the problem is here. What's the problem with your dad getting a background check if you give him a gun for Christmas? You send
I'm not saying it's a huge problem.
Okay, then what are you wasting my time for? We have spent 10 minutes on this, and you're calling and complaining because you think that people are alienated for because they say common sense and you feel alienated? I got to tell you, Ryan, you're the one who's alienating because you're just being obtuse. Like, you know what the cost to society is? If you got to get a background check for your dad when he gets a gun, nothing. If there is .0000000001% value in it, I'll do it. That's common sense.
People are calling for universal background checks. We're going to spend all this political capital to pass something that accomplishes nothing.
All right. I think there is value in you saying that, but the bottom line is that's not how political capital works. To the extent that that's the only thing that they can go in on, people would be calling for a lot more, but they're trying to do the least amount that is least offensive to people who are sensitive about hearing things called common sense gun laws. People who get sensitive about hearing something that people say is common sense and they think they have a better idea for the gun thing. You want to talk about wasting political capital. You've just had 20 minutes or 10 minutes to talk about this, and you've achieved nothing. All you've said is, I don't like their strategy, because I think that they're going for the wrong thing. But you haven't even told me what they should go for.
I mean, if you want something that's actually going to change, you know, especially mass shootings or gun deaths in general, you want to ban semi-automatic weapons.
Well, no, but like, what if I want to limit the number of suicides in this country? The 30,000 suicides by guns.
I mean, most effective for that would be a waiting time.
Right. Okay, so we're getting somewhere. I agree with you. I would go for a waiting period. But you know what? If there's a chance that you can get universal background sales, you're certainly going to be able to get a waiting period. I just don't think that your assessment of the political landscape is there. We're not dealing. This is not going to be a marginal thing. They're either going to pass something significant or they're not. It's not going to be because that they expended their capital on background checks for private, the loophole. It's a small part of any package. It's a weird thing to be irritated.
I'm not saying this is a huge issue. It's just a kind of a pet peeve.
Yeah. I think if we're talking, I appreciate the call, Ryan, but if you're worried about expenditure of political capital on something that's not hugely important, don't spend your time focused on something that's not hugely important. Lead by example. Jeez. All right, folks, we're out of time. Great. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that finally breaks you. I get somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my I don't know how